said all along, including back then, that there was a real chance that the Taliban would make significant gains throughout Afghanistan. But on the other hand, I have to tell you that the inability of Afghan security forces to defend their country has played a very powerful role in what we've seen over the last few weeks. The fact is, we invested, the international community invested, over 20 years, billions of dollars in these forces, 300,000 of them, with an Air Force, something the Taliban didn't have, with the most modern, sophisticated equipment. And unfortunately, tragically, they have not been able to defend the country. And I think that explains why this has moved as quickly as it's moved.
Secretary of State Antony Blinken on NBC's Meet the Press yesterday. President Biden is expected to speak about 40 minutes from now, and we will carry that live here on KCRW. Over the weekend, the Taliban seized control of Kabul, posing in Afghanistan's presidential palace. A chaotic evacuation of American personnel from the embassy echoes of the 1975 evacuation of Saigon. At Kabul's airport, a frantic scene as Afghans climbed jetways and clung to the sides of a U.S. military plane. The last 24 hours have been the worst-case scenario realized as America withdraws from Afghanistan. A 20-year war ends with the collapse of a U.S.-backed government and an Afghan military that laid down weapons instead of fighting Taliban insurgents. Here at home, millions of Americans are stunned by how it all happened. Let's discuss now with Vivian Salama, national security reporter for The Wall Street Journal. Welcome.
Thanks so much for having me.
Great to have you. And Mike Jason, retired U.S. Army officer who helped train Afghanistan's forces in 2012. Welcome to you.
Thanks. It's an honor to be here.
It's an honor to have you. Well, tell us how you're reacting. You were in Afghanistan back in 2012, cautiously optimistic when you returned home that you had actually trained an effective force. And now this.
Yeah, it's, you know, it's a bit of deja vu. I also supervise and train forces in Iraq. To watch them collapse, you know, three years later when ISIS rolled through. And it caused me to have to really relook the whole picture and my role in it, in my little corner of the global war on terror. And so I think all of us who were there knew in some way this day was coming. If you think, the analogy of the boiling frog, like the water was just heating and heating and heating. And at some point it was gonna tilt. The speed of it has been a shock to the point where it's really hard, as I talk to my peers and stuff, to process it emotionally, professionally, spiritually right now. But you know, we're also really consumed with the crisis on the ground right now, with trying to save real lives of our friends, colleagues, interpreters. And I think that's the case with you all as well. All of you had bureaus in various cities and Afghan nationals working with you and NGOs and other agencies. So I think there's a real emergency right now that we have to contend with as well.
Right. A little later in the show, we'll be talking with an interpreter whose brother also is an interpreter, and he is stuck in Afghanistan. And so we'll get his story in a moment. But how many people do you think are affected? The categories you just mentioned, all the interpreters and the personnel who worked with the United States over the last, 20 years, how many need to get out of the country now?
It's really hard to say. The number that I saw batted around when this issue sort of hit the forefront about a month or two ago was there are, if you count the people in this special immigration visa process alone, which is backlogged for years, and who have started an application and their families, we're talking 70,000. I don't think that includes the Afghan security forces, like my friend and classmate, who stuck there right now, who fought until the very last day and didn't leave, and he's got, you know, his wife and multiple kids. So how many more of those and local nationals who didn't think they were going to leave but are now in deathly danger? I can't fathom.
Vivian, how did this come to pass so quickly? It seems that even the highest level of American officials, from Secretary of State Blinken on down, are shocked. Why are they shocked? They must have had some intelligence on the ground.
They definitely had some intelligence. The intelligence assessments leading up to this had been saying that Kabul could likely fall within about 6 months of the withdrawal. And that had been a revised assessment from earlier predictions. And it sort of changed by the day with the circumstances changing off the daily. But ultimately, what we saw was that the withdrawal itself happened so quickly. If you all recall, President Biden had initially said that he was aiming for a September 11th withdrawal. That had changed because the military essentially determined that, you know what, if we're doing a withdrawal, then we need to get out right now because the situation could become dire. And especially when the Taliban sort of knows that there is a concrete withdrawal date, you don't want to really be withdrawing around that time. And so, you know, for security reasons. And so they decided to kind of make that, speed things up and make that an earlier withdrawal with so many of the remaining US forces out before the July 4th holiday. And so you had that coupled with the fact that over the past, let's say, year or two, the Taliban had really been gaining strength. They'd been gaining territory. They'd been gaining momentum, most of all, in terms of their capabilities. All the while, what we've seen is that the Afghan military and the Afghan government were sort of flailing. And a lot of questions that we keep on getting in recent weeks is, we've spent billions of dollars on to prop up the Afghan government, to prop up the Afghan military. Where did all that money go and what on earth is happening? And it's a little bit complicated, but ultimately what you see is a couple of things. A, there's rampant corruption within the Afghan government, a lot of infighting. And so you don't really have sort of this concrete unified front to take over the country because of that, those issues. Secondly, the Afghan military has a lot of issues in its, in and of itself. Meager salaries to these fighters who are, in many cases, fighting in these outposts away from their families, barely getting anything, any payment. Some of them don't even get food on some days. And so with all that in mind, they don't really have the incentive to then go and put their lives on the line and fight the Taliban. All the while, they've been relying so heavily on U.S. airstrikes and U.S. ground troops to support them. And so, so many things factoring into this that ultimately led when the U.S. withdrawal began, we just saw the Afghan government and military crumble before our eyes.
Mike, can you give us a picture of what the forces look like? I've been reading that they came in so woefully unprepared that it was impossible to train them to be a fighting force that could defend the country. I mean, most of them couldn't even read, I understand, when they were first
recruited.
Right.
No, that's right. And I think you got to go back even further. You got to go back to 2001 when we invade Afghanistan, rightful vengeance and rage from 9/11. And then we took the country over very swiftly with very light forces. We messaged we weren't staying. I mean, I was in there in 2012 and I was still in a tent because the messaging and optics are we are not here to stay. So it's very light footprint. And we didn't really start building institutions. And then, you know, 18 months later, we're already in Iraq. And then the ball switches over there. So do the resources. Then we end Iraq and we go back and we surge in Afghanistan. But then ISIS comes back. So we sort of, and then four administrations sequentially putting timelines on the clock. We're leaving, we're not leaving. Just sort of And I have found myself an advisor in both of these theaters. And the Army is not equipped institutionally, the U.S. Army, none of our armies, to build up another nation's institution. We just did it out of hide. And we don't have doctrine for it. And so, you know, we sort of bumbled through it. And then at some point, somebody realized, well, they don't have a national police. They need a police. So let U.S. Army and their friends do it. So we took on that role while rotating people borrowed from other headquarters to sort of try to figure this out. But a friend of mine said today, I thought it was great. It was, you know, we built an army that looked like us, technological, requiring oversight, requiring zero corruption and education and servant leaders and an expeditionary army, actually, not an army that is in a garrison in their own country, because that's what we are. But we did it before we built a country that could control and run and operate such an army. We put the horse before the cart. We built an army that cost $5 billion a year to maintain, which is more than the entire Afghan GDP. And again, it was just this ham-fisted effort with multiple acronyms starting 20 years ago. And then we sort of wonder why this thing starts to collapse. And then in 15, 16, we really stopped going out with them. And as you said, the Taliban picked up momentum over the last 5 or 6 years And it's, if you're an Afghan and you're already coming in, you're being paid poorly, like you said, you're uneducated, you've got this, you see the security forces really is kind of like a jobs program. You're far away from home. Your commander might be fleecing your own money. You've got no food. They take away your cell phones. You're getting shot at by the Taliban. And they're watching the news, and they're seeing the Americans, the Europeans all saying, well, we're going to stay, we're going to go, we're leaving. And the Taliban saying, whatever they're doing, we're coming back.
Yeah.
At some point, you start hedging your bet for your safety and the safety of your family. And that's, I think, what played out. We never built the institutions that could replicate, sustain, and support the army that we tried to create for them.
So that $5 billion a year, as you say, that did not go to salaries, I guess. Where did it go?
You know, I mean, it was, I think, the total effort in the, as the SIGAR, I forget how you say the acronym, but as we allotted it, was about $89 billion of U.S. taxpayers for creating Afghan institutions. And you look at, I mean, the equipment, the training, Humvees, MRAPs, EOD, computers, laptops, rifles, pistols, belt buckles. I mean, it's just a lot of money. And then the salary, you know, I don't know how that works. That's beyond my level, but I think there's a huge fund in Kabul, and then they apportioned it. And as we know, as we've been watching, we didn't exactly watch how they did it, but we know there's a strong history of corruption, and all the way down to that private getting a paycheck, part of it was being pulled by somebody else. Grifted over here, stolen over here, and potentially a lot of it went to the Taliban as well, funding their operations.
Vivian, what role does President Biden play in all of this from when he was vice president under Obama? And, you know, I know this whole end of the war winding down, pulling back the troops was negotiated by President Trump and Mike Pompeo, but he has said he has no regrets. So is he owning what is looking like an unmitigated catastrophe?
Well, President Biden is scheduled to speak later today on Monday afternoon. He cut his trip to Camp David short in order to address the crisis and the images that we're seeing. But funny enough, this is the issue that I'm really focused on and writing about today, is sort of President Biden's trajectory on Afghanistan in particular, because we know from our sources and also from President Obama's own memoirs, where he talks about then Vice President Biden's reluctance to increase troop numbers in Afghanistan and stay all together. He believed that the generals were sort of cornering him, and according to how President Obama described it at the time, and just felt like it was a bad move, that the U.S. was not benefiting from that relationship anymore. And, you know, President Biden echoes the sentiments of a lot of folks in Washington, policymakers in Washington, including, ironically, former President Trump, who also believed that the U.S. wasn't benefiting. The sense among these folks is, okay, we went in there to root out Al-Qaeda, to sort of degrade their capabilities, to make sure that Afghanistan was not a launching pad for terrorist attacks on the homeland, on the U.S., down the line. And we sort of achieved that. And over time, maybe we helped to open schools and do other things in Afghanistan that were really great for society, for the social for the social elements of society. But like your other guest is saying, Mike, I believe is his name, we didn't build the institutions. And that was problematic because of the fact that, you know, if you don't have institutions, then a government is hollow on the inside. And so this was something that President Biden said, you know what? We've just been providing life support for the Afghan government. If after 20 years they have not been able to kind of get it together, then we should not be there anymore, because we don't want another person to lose their life. We don't want another American tax dollar spent if that's not going to go toward the future. And of course, there's a lot of backward-looking policy failures that are involved in sort of where we came to today. But President Biden ultimately said, you know what, we're not doing nation building. I don't want another to be there for another day longer. It's over. We have a lot of problems at home, and we need to focus on that. And remember, there's also one more point. There's also a very personal element of this for President Biden. His late son, Beau Biden, who died of cancer a few years ago, he himself was a soldier. He fought in Iraq. He was deployed in Iraq. And so for President Biden, a lot of this is personal. He says, would I want to send my own child out to war to where they could risk dying? And ultimately, his advisors tell us the answer was no for him. And so if he doesn't want to do that for his own child, he doesn't want to do that for anyone else's child, too. And so for him, that is part of it, too. And so, so many complex issues guiding his thoughts there.
Well, I want to thank you both so much for joining us today. Vivian Salama, national security reporter for The Wall Street Journal. Mike Jason, retired U.S. Army officer who helped train Afghanistan's forces back in 2012. Thank you both so much.
Thank you.
Coming up, women and girls made huge gains in the last 20 years. Can they hang on to some of them under Taliban rule? That's next on Press Play.
Hi, it's Terry Gross, the host of Fresh Air. We bring you in-depth, long-form interviews with actors, directors, musicians, authors, journalists, and more. Listen to our Peabody Award-winning Fresh Air podcast from WHYY and NPR.
This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. So what happens next in Afghanistan and what progress made in the last 20 years stays? For women living in Afghanistan, the last two decades saw huge strides in equality, impossible under Taliban rule. They went to school. They worked outside their homes. They trained as police officers, as journalists, even elected as members of parliament. Now, with the Taliban back in power, do these gains evaporate? And what is the United States' role in resettling refugees, especially those who worked for the Americans? We have two people now to discuss this. Lindsay Addario, Pulitzer Prize-winning photojournalist who covered the war in Afghanistan for The New York Times and Time magazine, and she's reported on that country both before and after the U.S. invasion. Welcome back, Lindsay.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
Great to have you. And joining us as well is Kismet Amin. He's a former translator for the U.S. military, and he resettled in the United States about 4 years ago. Welcome to you, Kismet.
Hey, good afternoon, everyone. Thank you for having me.
Great to have you. Let's begin with you. You are in Dallas, Texas, but I understand your family is still in Afghanistan. Where are they, and how are they doing now?
Well, my family is actually, I've been talking to my family. I mean, this has been a really, really tough week because I've been in contact with my family, talking to them every day. They're actually in Jalalabad City, which was already been, under Taliban control. They're staying in a home, and it's actually really, really terrifying because, I have a family member who worked with the U.S. military as an interpreter, but also I have a sister there. I have a sister who worked at the Women for Women organization. I also have another sister that she was going to school, college, and she was studying business. So everything is actually under Taliban control right now, and people actually don't know what the tomorrow is holding for them. So they are really, really terrifying, and it's just a nightmare. To be honest,
It sounds like it. Are they trying to leave, or are they planning on trying to leave?
Well, honestly, right now, what I'm trying to figure out is that I wanted to, to make a plan for them to get them out of the country. But as of right now, they're literally stuck in the country because not everyone in the family have a passport. First, everybody needs to get a passport in order to relocate and move to a different country, but now nobody has a passport. But even if you want to have a passport, since everything is under Taliban control, all the organizations and offices are closed, so we don't know for how long these organizations are going to be closed. And even if you have a passport, you don't know what embassy is open, so you can actually go there and apply for a visa, whether that's like India or Tajikistan or Uzbekistan or any surrounding country. So we're in that situation that we're stuck in. We're trying to figure out, like, what's the best way for them in order to flee the country. Because, like I said, we have a few members in a family. They have like a brother, have a background working for the U.S. military. Have a sister that worked for the Women and Women organization. Also have another sister that goes to school. So we're just stuck. I mean, they're literally stuck right now.
Wow, I'm so sorry. Lindsay, a lot of Afghans now in that position. Let's talk specifically with you about women and girls, and you've interviewed many women and girls over your years in Afghanistan. What are your primary concerns for them?
Well, I think my primary concern is that the first time I went to Afghanistan, it was under Taliban rule. And so I am familiar with how they governed last time, and it was pretty terrifying. I was able to get a visa to go there three times between 2000 and early 2001. And as a woman, an American woman who was unmarried at the time, I needed a man to take me around, and I had to sneak into people's homes. Photography of any living thing was illegal. Women could not work outside the home except for a few doctors. Very brave Afghan women opened secret girls' schools in their basements and their homes. And so essentially I was running around photographing this underground network of what life was like for women under the Taliban. Over the last 20 years, I've sort of photographed and documented women finding their voice, as journalists, as doctors, as aid workers, as everything, delivering babies, graduating from high school, graduating from college. I've watched them sort of really get out there and live their lives. And it is not easy in a place like Afghanistan, because even though it was no longer under the Taliban, it is still a deeply conservative tribal culture. And it is not easy for a woman to get permission to work outside the home. And so, everything was a negotiation and a very delicate balance of how do you as an Afghan woman abide to the sort of cultural norms and also, have the freedom and liberty to go out and work. And a lot of that is dependent on the men in their family.
And we just heard Kismet talking about his sisters, one of whom works for a women's rights organization. Are women like that going to be targeted, especially by the Taliban?
I mean, my phone has been blowing up for a week now, and with former translators, with women in parliament, with people who have worked as women's activists, and they are terrified. They are stuck at home. No one ever believed, of course, the Taliban would take over so quickly. And if you look at something, the thing that I've realized watching the images sort of obsessively coming out of Afghanistan is there are almost no women on the street. Already, it's exactly like it was under the Taliban. And so, all of those women who have been out working every single day for the last X amount of years are at home because they're terrified naturally. So I don't know what the future is. I think the Taliban is, of course, on their best behavior right now. They're making all sorts of promises that women can stay in school and go to high school and graduate and work. But really, the truth will lie in what happens when all of the foreigners are out of the country, and probably in the next 2 to 3 weeks.
Kismet, what do you make of the Taliban's promises? Do you think they're hollow?
Well, just picking back off what, Lindsay, she said, uh-huh. Just picking back on that. Yeah, Lindsay. I think exactly. So the Taliban's right now, the fear is that when you go, I don't know if you're following the news, but when you see these Taliban's on the street in a city, if you have a garment, obviously you have a uniform, you have a different forces, whether it's a police or an army or it's a special forces, so you have the uniform. But as of right now, if you see these people, you don't recognize these people. Some are wearing just the Afghan jammies. Some are wearing just the uniform. Some are just wearing slippers. Some are wearing just shoes. So that's really terrifying because you cannot trust these people. And exactly, I think what they're trying to do, and I think they have done it, the history has repeated, and we have seen it, is that they're trying to get their place among the people and trying to get their trust. And once they do that, obviously after, withdrawing all the U.S. troops and not having any sort of, foreign presence in the country, that's a big fear that these people are most likely will turn back to how they were back in 20 years ago. Because they're in the power. Even look at, we have 300,000 troops, and those 300,000 troops were surrendered. I don't know what kind of deal it was. But now these people literally have a power over everything, and they can literally make a rule, and they can literally run the country how they wanted to. So exactly, people are terrifying, and we're not seeing any women on the street, not even women. You can't see a lot of men there. Like my brother, he's a man, but he's terrifying for himself. He said, I can't even go outside. He goes outside just like maybe walk for a few blocks and then come back. He said, like, well, nobody told me anything, but I think I'm smelling something, like something's going to happen. So people are really terrified. People don't know what their future is. A lot of people were in the middle of, you know, graduating from school, graduating from colleges. People had jobs, you know. Afghanistan was a great, I mean, it wasn't the best government, but at least we had a government that we could trust in, and we know that nobody's going to hurt us. But now, like, I'm sure you've seen this few cases, they capture a few people who are trying to, you know, trying to steal something, and these people were actually beaten, and they were bleeding on the street. I know they didn't do well. I mean, they didn't do a good thing, but the thing is that this is not how the justice needs to be, you know, this is not a justice. You're trying to, you know, beat people in front of the people on the street. That shows brutality. That shows how wild these people are. So it's already scaring. It's already scaring because, like, my mom, she actually collects all the documents of my brother who worked for the U.S. military, all the certificates, the letters that my sister has, the school documents that we had. She actually sealed them in the pillow, like in the pillow, just to make sure in case if these people start to search homes and try and look for evidence. But the evidence is pretty evident. Like, it's out there. People know who they are. And there are people that are already trying to join the Taliban. Like, yeah. I talked to my family this morning.
Just out of pure survival, I imagine.
Yeah, even for survival. And these people could be a really good asset for them to give them all the intel. Like, we have our neighbor. They joined the Taliban. And these people are, so now that's scary. And we should be aware of that.
All right. We're going to have to end it there, unfortunately. Thank you both so much for coming on the show today. And Kismet, the very best of luck for you and your family. And I hope they can stay safe.
Thank you.
Yeah, appreciate that. Thank you so much for your time.
Kismet Amin, former translator for the U.S. military. Lindsay Addario, Pulitzer Prize-winning photojournalist who works for the New York Times, National Geographic, and Time magazine. And just a reminder, President Biden is expected to address the nation on the situation in Afghanistan in just a few moments at 12:45, and we will carry that live, so don't go anywhere.
Support comes from USC Online, providing exceptional online graduate programs, certificates, and upskilling for current and aspiring professionals. Earn your graduate degree in a flexible online format from University of Southern California and learn from faculty at the top of their fields in areas such as business, health, law, engineering, psychology, communications, and more. Explore your options today at online.usc.edu.
This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. Well, earlier this month, the CDC extended its eviction moratorium until October 3rd. The original moratorium had been challenged in court, and so is this one. On Friday, though, a federal judge in Washington let it stay for now, even as she expressed doubts about whether it would survive further legal scrutiny. It's Monday, so Jessica Levinson is here. She is a Loyola Law School professor and, of course, our regular legal here on Press Play. Hi there.
Hi there.
So the original moratorium expired July 31st. This new one was narrower in scope than the original one, right? So give us the details there.
Just ever so slightly narrower in scope. It basically says it's just applying to areas where COVID transmission is high. Unfortunately, as we all know, that means about 90% of the country. So yes, on its face, more narrowly tailored, in practice, still applies to a whole lot of renters.
Okay, so the Biden administration always wanted intended the original moratorium to expire on July 31st. Of course, Delta happens, and then the CDC extended it. But even when Biden announced this extension a couple of weeks ago, he acknowledged that it has some legal problems. Here's what he said.
The bulk of the constitutional scholarship says that it's not likely to pass constitutional muster, number one. But there are several key scholars who think that it may, and it's worth the effort.
Okay, so what is he saying? Why wouldn't it pass constitutional muster?
Yeah, so what he's saying is basically, I read what the Supreme Court wrote in June, and I've talked to lawyers, and I understand what you're saying, everybody, that this might not actually withstand constitutional muster. And what he means is that this shouldn't continue coming potentially from the CDC, that if we really want to keep extending this eviction ban, this eviction moratorium, it should come from Congress. And what he's specifically talking about is in June, when the previous eviction moratorium was appealed up to the Supreme Court. The Supreme Court basically said, okay, we're going to let this eviction moratorium continue because it's just really a few more days until July 31st. It was a matter of weeks, but it was a 5-4 decision. And Justice Kavanaugh voted with the five members of the majority. But what he said was basically, don't do this again. If you want another eviction moratorium, then Congress, you need to act, you need to give clear authorization. And that's not what happened. And that's why we saw that battle between President Biden and Speaker Pelosi, where she said, I think she was quoted as saying, I don't care, find better lawyers. I don't have the votes and we need to extend this eviction moratorium. So that's what he's saying, is he's referring to that June ruling and he's referring to the idea that maybe this shouldn't continue to come from the CDC. These eviction moratoriums should come from Congress.
Well, why does it come from the CDC?
So it comes from the CDC because there is an old 1944 law that has really broad language that basically says the CDC has power to try and prevent the spread of transmissible diseases. So for instance, the CDC can say, we're going to have a quarantine. Now, what we haven't, luckily, because we don't have these pandemics very regularly, what we haven't really tested is how much further can that language allow the CDC to go? Can it, for instance, allow for these eviction moratoriums? Now, the eviction moratorium started during the Trump administration, and it kind of went up and back. Congress allowed it, then the CDC allowed it. And we're now at the point where I think a lot of legal scholars would say we're kind of stretching the CDC's authority here. On the other hand, what the Biden administration might say is, as you said, look, things changed since June. The Delta variant is much more virulent, and therefore that broad language in the 1944 law would allow for the CDC to have this power. Again, one of those really interesting unanswered legal questions that we just haven't confronted before.
Is it because it's a stretch to say an eviction moratorium is put in place to stop the spread of a disease? Is that what the argument is? That it's basically to stop, well, an economic catastrophe for many people, but not necessarily to stop the spread of a disease?
Well, I think what supporters would say is, look, if people are evicted, then they're going to be in places that are less safe and will allow the virus to spread. For instance, they might be, unfortunately, on the street, or they might be in homeless shelters, or they might have to move in with other family members. So that it's not just the economic catastrophe, which in and of itself obviously is important, but it's also the idea that they might be in living situations where there are more people grouped together and that that would directly allow for the virus to spread.
So the judge said what on Friday?
So on Friday, this is a lower court judge, a trial court judge, who basically said, look, my hands are tied. It was really interesting to hear what she said. She gave each side kind of a hard time. And she said, look, there's an appellate court decision. I have to let this eviction moratorium stay in place, but I know you're going to appeal this. And basically, she said, I'm going to watch the appeal. And the appeal's going to happen really quickly. I think it was over the weekend that the panel was chosen. And they set a briefing schedule for this week. So we might have an answer from at least the DC Court of Appeals this week on this particular question.
Hmm. Well, do you think the Supreme Court will weigh in before this expires in October?
So I think it's going to go to them, whether or not they weigh in or they just basically give a check mark or an X. This will be an emergency appeal. So they could do something very brief and just say, basically, we're letting the lower court decision stand, or they could decide to give at least some reasoning like we saw Justice Kavanaugh give back in June. I do think that they They just can't avoid it, though. It'll come before them in some form.
Okay, speaking of emergencies, we're going to pivot now to the California Supreme Court, which upheld a lower court ruling that supported Governor Gavin Newsom's use of emergency powers during the pandemic. What were the emergency powers that he used that the court upheld?
Yeah, the emergency powers here that we were talking about were really dealing with the election and whether or not we could suspend certain restrictions and say we're going to send vote by mail ballots to every eligible voter. But we know that there have also been challenges to the emergency powers that he used for everything from the stay at home orders to relaxing school restrictions. I mean, as we've talked about over the last 17 months now, these emergency powers are much broader than really any of us potentially would have realized.
All right, the all-powerful Jessica Levinson from Loyola Law School and our regular Legal Eagle here on Press Play. Thank you.
Thank you.
Coming up, some new music for you. We'll meet funk and soul singer Gavin Turek. She has a new album out. Gavin Turek, next on Press Play. This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. Well, typically, a debut record makes a statement, an artist's entrance into their hopefully long and fruitful career. Sometimes, though, that debut is delayed after years of grinding it out in the industry. And that's the story behind LA-based funk singer Gavin Turek's debut album. It's called Madam Gold. Magazine called Gavin Turek a rising artist to watch. Since then, she has toured the world with major acts like Toki Monsta and Mayor Hawthorne. She put out an EP, but despite that success, putting out a full-length album wasn't easy. And Gavin Turek is with me now to tell us that story. Welcome to Press Play.
Thank you for having me.
And congratulations. It's great to have you. And that's great. Congratulations. Yes. Madam Gold is out.
It is. Wow. It's been a journey, so I'm happy it's out. Yeah.
Well, talk about that journey. How was it such a journey? What were the difficulties?
Oh my goodness. I have always been one of those kids, one of those people that grew up to be an adult who has a lot of expectations and a lot of high expectations for where I see myself going, how I see my career playing out. And I just always had this vision of it happening a certain way, certain timeline. And when that wasn't happening, I had to kind of reconcile with that and decide to keep going despite a lot of disappointment, despite a lot of setbacks and self-doubt, honestly. Mm. That's kind of the story of what became Madam Gold. And the fact that I'm still here today is really because of this superhero that I found in myself. And she allowed me to keep going and put out the album.
So Madam Gold is an alter ego in a way, kind of a Ziggy Stardust?
Yes, absolutely. I basically had this image of her, Madam Gold, who is an alter ego, inspired by a beautiful artist that I became familiar with years ago. Her name is Renee Cox, and she is a visual artist. And basically, in the pandemic, in quarantine, I was alone a lot, and I got really in my head a lot, like everybody, right? And because of the delays in the release of the album, I found myself just kind of at rock bottom in my way. And I stumbled upon a interview that she was giving with another artist. It was an artist talk. And she so eloquently put out her story, which was that she had to decide at a certain point in her career whether or not she was going to continue portraying herself the same way, which in her mind was a victim or to portray herself as a superhero. And that story and that way that she visualized herself in these self-portraits was so inspiring to me that I kind of got that download moment for Madame Gold, which became obviously my alter ego superhero.
So there you are in your apartment in the pandemic, and you're inspired by Renee Cox and becoming a superhero. And how did you then attack the music when you have this revelation?
Well, I already had started the album making process actually long before that. I had started writing and demoing songs for the album in 2018, actually. So at the point that I was in 2020, when I came across that interview, I was deep into the process with my partner and my main collaborator. And where that conversation, where that, I guess, her testimony, her story, how that kind of transpired into the completion of the album was that I had all these songs, I didn't have much direction, and I realized in that moment that what I had created thus far was beautiful, it was intimate, it was vulnerable, it was brutally honest, it had a lot of my pain embedded in these songs and in the lyrics, but it was portraying me, it was kind of stopping at this victim story. And after I heard Renee's story and had this vision for Madame Gold, it really inspired me to get back in the studio, work on some more songs. So I went back and ended up writing, I think, 4 or 5 more songs and added some interludes as well. And then it ended, I guess I concluded the album with my thesis statement, which was the song Hero. Really just is about how I was on that floor, you know, looking full of fear, looking down at my phone. Like I say, I can't even take my head away from the screen. And by the end of the song, I'm saying that despite all of the noise, all of the chaos internally, externally in the world that I'm going through, I guess I'm going to have to be the hero and I'm going to have to keep going. And really that was when I finished that song, I was like, oh, the album's done. This is great.
So when you talk about the pain that you went through during the pandemic, are you talking about something? I mean, you're talking about, as you said earlier, the pain we all went through in terms of the pandemic. But is there something in particular that you're referring to?
Yeah, I guess for me, it was just that feeling of everything stopping and not knowing if I was going to be able to continue as an artist, honestly. I mean, I'm sure you've spoken to many artists that are performers and that is their primary income. And live shows, interactions with fans is something that not only allows me to eat, but it also really fuels my art and fuels my soul and keeps me invigorated and keeps me inspired. So when all of that came to a literal stop, it was devastating for me.
Yeah.
And I had to really reimagine myself, recreate myself. It really took a new way of looking at myself to just keep going. I keep on saying keep going, but that's really all it is. It's not so much, oh, I have to make something that sounds this way or need to win a certain award or need to have certain people validating me anymore. I think I'm winning if I just keep going. That's the point that I'm at. So it's really just saying, learning how to do that when everything around me had stopped.
Let's hear a little bit more from the record. Here's a song called So What. You know I love you so what? Yeah, you're so nasty. You're out of line. You crash my car. That's full of vulnerability there. Also, do I detect a little Prince influence?
Oh,
a lot of Prince influence?
A lot of, especially on that song. Yeah, that was a blatant homage, I would say, to Prince, one of my heroes.
And you're also really into disco, right?
Yeah, yeah.
A lot of your music sounds like is an homage to disco of the 70s, the 1970s. Yeah. But you weren't even born during the disco era, right? You were born in the late 80s?
I was, yes.
So why disco? What is it about disco that you love?
I became attached to this idea that I think disco captured, which was, it was a look, you know, it was a certain type of glamour, a certain type of movement and self-expression. I got the sense that there was a lot of freedom in expression in that era that was being cultivated and like propagated. And I just thought that was cool. Obviously I love dance music. And if you've ever seen me, perform, you know, I dance and I dance a lot and I really love expressing myself in that way as well. So I think when I was trying to figure out the best way to kind of package myself, that sounds so like unglamorous, but that's true. I have big hair, I have a big personality, and I kind of look like I come from that era anyways. So it was kind of just deciding to lean into that as a vehicle, like a visual vehicle and an expression. So I think that the music that I grew up listening to, it was a lot of disco and it was a lot of funk. My parents liked that kind of music. And so it was just kind of embracing who I am and then that part of my upbringing and seeing how I can make it my own. Because as you hear on the record, it's not disco necessarily. There's songs like So What that are very much inspired by Prince and in that funk era that he did so well. But I think my love for disco has really evolved into a love for just 70s funk and then figuring out how I can take this inspiration from that era and make it Gavin and make it so unique and make it so relevant to today. So it's been a hard but but like really fun just challenge, I think. That was what we were after for the record, at least. We wanted to be very relevant, but you gotta throw it back in order to move forward, as they say. So.
And you grew up here in Los Angeles, right?
I did. I'm an LA native.
Yay. Did you grow up in a musical household?
I did. I grew up in a very musical household. My dad is actually a phenomenal classical piano player. He's modest, but he's great. And my mom is a singer, and she's always sang. Like, she sang in coffee houses, she sang at church, she sang in our house. I watched her sing pretty much every day. She had developed a really just great practice. And so that was really modeled for me. I just saw her practicing all the time, preparing for shows, preparing for different events. And even though she always sang gospel, that just that example really inspired me. And so it was kind of a natural evolution for me to become a singer and take after her.
Well, let's hear one more song before we say goodbye. This one is called Simple Reasons. And I'm wondering if you could just set this one up for us.
Oh, this is one of my favorite songs. I wrote this about kind of the ending of a relationship. And I think it really captures that push and pull of talking to yourself into it and talking to yourself out of something that is just toxic. But I think that you kind of capture the bittersweetness of an ending like that and just the confusion.
Yeah, yeah, we can all relate.
Yes, absolutely. It's heavy, but I get excited for people to hear my music. So that's why you hear me laughing. You're like, what is this girl laughing about? I'm just excited. So that's all.
The song is called Simple Reasons. It's off the new album, Madam Gold, by Gavin Turek. Gavin, it's been such a pleasure. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
And that's it for the show today. Thanks so much for listening. Don't forget, you can download or subscribe to our podcast and listen whenever you want. It's at kcrw.com/pressplay. I'm Madeline Brand. I'll see you tomorrow. Put me in prison. What's the fact that I couldn't be free?